Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is Janine, and you're listening to Lunch with Loudon. Coffee Talk radio shows are part of the Coffee Party Be the Media project. You can join our team at www.coffeepartyusa.com/volunteer. Be the Media. So I know that if you watch the promotion for the show today, you're expecting to hear Tim Danahay's show that was recorded on November 5th. He and Egberto Huile discussed the midterm elections, and because I have a last-minute guest who I was dying to hear from is going to be with us here today, you can listen to that broadcast next week, Thanksgiving, or anytime after by going to Blog Talk Radio, Coffee Talk Radio, and the link will be up on the Lunch with Loudon Facebook page. But today, I have to tell you, I'm here to speak about the situation in Ferguson. I know that we're all awaiting a grand jury decision. There's been a lot of talk of, you know, which way should this go. There's just so much to talk about that I don't want to jump the gun and speak before we have a chance to speak with our guest, Dan Johnson. And so, unfortunately, I don't know the number he's calling in from, so what I'm going to do right now is open up the mic for 620 and see if this is our guest who is calling in. No. Well, perhaps it is. I'm going to open up there, code 620. Hello, you're on Lunch with Loudon. With whom am I speaking?
Oh, this is Jack.
Hey, Jack. We are awaiting a call from Dan Johnson, who's going to talk to us about the situation in Ferguson today. But please, we've got a few seconds on the mic. Let us know what you're thinking about today.
Well, let's see. Okay. This is way back when, 65. I did a study on worked for the Metropolitan Youth Commission of St. Louis and St. Louis County.
Uh-huh.
And Ferguson at that time was two-thirds white. And I didn't directly participate in that particular study, but I know we're doing a study on juvenile delinquency. And the guy involved, 18 years old, you go up to the age of 18 for juvenile delinquency, and you get, and the guy that's involved, was killed, was 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Brown.
Yes.
Now my opinion is that why the heck did we have a grand jury for that when it was obvious, pretty obvious, that that a cop killed that boy. Not really a boy, he's a man.
He's a young man. And let me give you my 10-second analysis of that, and hopefully we'll discuss it more, Jack. Thank you for calling in with the question. Basically, a grand jury would always indict. That's where indictments come from. And so I think that we confuse arrest with indictment. Cases can go before the grand jury with or without an arrest, but there's a case. There's a case being considered. So I'm less concerned that they're using a grand jury. I'm actually pleased that this has continued. And if this is an authentic study of the issue and the facts at hand to see if there's adequate information for an indictment. I think that's a healthy thing. It is the law, and it's part of what we do. You know, we are a country of law. And so the fact that there's a grand jury is less concerning for me than how things are going to go from the point where they make their announcement on. I'm going to open area code 404.
Hey, Janine.
Hi.
This is Bobby Rodrigo. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I'm I should tell our listeners that Bobby was instrumental in being able to call in our guest today, and so here I am with a cold cup of coffee thinking I was going to rebroadcast another show, and we are live. So thank you very much,
Fantastic.
Bobby.
Fantastic.
Fantastic.
You're welcome.
And so my since Dan hasn't called in yet, maybe you and I could chat for just a couple minutes about what the actual issues are on the ground there now in Ferguson. And I appreciate Jack's question, why was there a grand jury in the first place? And I think that you could probably even speak to that more eloquently than I did.
Well, certainly. And I thank you, Janine, for the subject. It's very important what's going on in Ferguson, continues to be, and your interest in it is important as well. From the grand jury standpoint, yeah, and what you had answered is actually correct, as correct as I could say it. You know, the grand juries are charged with indicting, reviewing the evidence in secret. I've been a little concerned about some of the rhetoric that has been coming since the grand jury started. I won't feed into whether or not it was leaked or not. I have no idea. I'm not there. I'm not the one taking the report. But it is the proper way to go. Now, there are instances in our society where grand juries are not used, and in that case, they have preliminary hearings, probable cause hearings, weighed hearings, all different named type hearings, depending upon what jurisdiction you're in. But those are directions that are taken when grand juries are either waived or the situation doesn't warrant it, and that's not too often. So it is the right way for it to go. Unfortunately, in some of these violent police actions that have gone on, in my view, overly violent police actions that have gone on, and of course by that I don't want to take away from the fact that a young man died. I don't have an opinion, and I've never really voiced an opinion on that particular thing because, again, I wasn't there. I didn't witness it, and I would prefer for the process to go out. But we are now waiting for that process, and it seems to me by the actions of the governor of Missouri and our mainstream media, among other people, that we're looking at a situation that's going to escalate in a very, very bad way. And I've seen a lot of evidence to that fact coming from so many different directions, it's hard to keep up with. I'm hoping I'm pleasantly surprised, but I really think that we're going to see some of the worst behavior we've ever seen in our country if they come back and say that the officer's not going to be charged without saying whether that's the right decision or not, because of what I'm seeing out there in the world and various organizations and media, anti-media, protesters, activists from the police side of it, so many different things that are making me that people are pushing buttons, and I think we're looking at something that's going to be horrible, unfortunately.
Well, and I always feel, Bobby, that when too much posturing in any position sort of thwarts the intent of due process. In other words, I don't want to say that the grand jury is a sham. I don't want to predict what they're going to decide. I don't want to assume they don't know what they're doing. You know what I'm saying? And all of these
Absolutely.
Actions that we're talking about, all these actions that are happening are, to me, a little bit shocking. And, for example, the Congressional Black Caucus, the new leader of the Congressional Black Caucus, came out today publicly pressing for an indictment and warning, you know, like doing a shout-out to violence if there is no indictment. And I thought that that was hugely responsible. I think it's very different from just having an opinion. And I think that we should all express our opinions. Don't get me wrong about that. I'm a big believer in freedom of speech, and I'm a big believer in the right to assembly, and I'm a big believer in peaceful protest. And one of the other things that concerns me, and maybe you've been following this, is sort of there's been a ping-pong game going on about, so first the FBI warns of extremists hidden among peaceful protesters. And I think that probably was a legitimate concern. They had intel. They were concerned that there are among those many, there may be some with an alternative motivation. This is valid. I certainly think that it's good for law enforcement to prepare for that possibility, especially if there's intel. What I didn't appreciate was when people turned around and took out of that statement terrorist or, you know, and painted everyone who might protest, who could possibly protest, as among, you know, now they're terrorists, right? And think, you know, Reverend Barber, think Moral Monday. Think that there have been many, many people here, and certainly Dan Johnson, when he was being a citizen journalist, live streaming from Ferguson, just post circumstance in Ferguson, he certainly saw some chaos, but he also saw a lot of committed, peaceful protests. And so leaves me uncomfortable. Go ahead, Bobby.
Well, see, one of the reasons why I'm so, I don't know if depressed is not the right word, I'm so worried, I guess is the right way to put it, is because when Dan was there, we got a really good look at what was going on the way he described. And the other thing that he was doing for me is that he was clearing up some disinformation that we were receiving from whatever faction we were getting it from. A great example of that was there was some reports by Fox News and by right-wing media that the Black Panthers were doing one thing when it was, in fact, a person who was not a member of the Black Panthers. And Dan, you know, witnessed the Black Panthers working well with the community, for example, and doing positive things with the community and not doing violence. Then the other thing that we saw as well was we, as you know, we had a really hard time with the lack of response from the so-called liberty movement that's in this country, militias and a number of organizations that stand for, or they say they stand for, the Constitution. And there was hardly the same kind of a response as there was in the Bundy Ranch. And it was very noticeable, especially to the local community. And we called them out on that. And some of the things that I've been seeing, like we all have been seeing, just to give you an example of how crazy this is right now. I posted an article the day before on our Coffee Party page that dealt with an employee for the Drury Hotel chain that was fired because he sent out pictures of all the Department of Homeland Security vehicles that were parked at his hotel just outside of the Ferguson area, alerting people and letting them know what was going on there. We're talking about a lot of vehicles that are sitting there ready for response. And then we have the governor doing a state of an emergency before the fact. We have a police force in the area that has come out and said specifically that they are not prepared for what they're being told may happen if this goes a certain way. And they have been asking for leadership within their own community police forces to help them. Add to that, I just read this morning, I was looking at the Missouri Oathkeepers page, and they had posted this article that I was reading from a media publication called Revolutionary News. So I, you know, in order to vet it and vet the information, I went right to the website, and there it was on their website. They are advocating is violent, and we're not going to let the pig. And this is the word pig is right on this media thing that they're putting out about this. If the indictment doesn't go that way, and then of course the Oath Keepers are educating their area because they. If, in fact, the police officer was justified. crucified, they're going to stand with him because he's an oath keeper. Now, they're not with him if he wasn't justified, and they're not coming out one way or the other. And I can honestly say that because of my interaction with them. But just that escalation there, and then there's been some, then there was yesterday, there was a thing put out by a black group that their name, the color black is, the word black is in their name. And I'll have to, I'm driving at the moment, so I can't dig it up and put it in your chat room. But they had put out that any storekeepers that decide to defend themselves or to hurt any of the protesters, they're never going to be open again. And this is the kind of things that we don't need going on in this circumstance. It, you know, it's like, it's the old story, you know, as you know, I'm an advocate of the freedom of speech as much as you are, but it's the old story about you can't yell fire in a movie theater. You know, we have people out there that are stirring a pot in the way where it's inciting, in my view. And then, of course, you have all these outside influences. So I'm thinking heavily about the community of Ferguson, hoping that they aren't, you know, they're not being brought into something that by other outside forces that they don't, you know, that'll be bad. I just see bad coming. That's hard to describe. I've been really worried for a couple of weeks now, actually.
Yeah, well, and especially, you know, there's been a crescendo, you know, starting with this FBI intel and the report that allowed for the calling of the National Guard, the state of emergency, to prepare for a grand jury announcement. You know, I understand the rationale there, and I certainly appreciate that while I have in my bones, because of, you know, I'm 63 years old, I have in my bones what happened at Kent State so long ago.
Sure.
I still feel, you know, I'm trying to sort of override the terror at the idea that the National Guard would be there. They're certainly better prepared for this than they were back then, and hopefully more in tune to the fact that the great, vast, overwhelming majority of people who are expressing their concerns about what has happened in Ferguson are peaceful protesters. And then you always have the opportunity for these, for folks to sort of sneak in. And so, yeah, people calling for violence, I get it. But it's not that terribly different than, I think a case in point right now is, for example, this whole thing between the Ku Klux Klan and Anonymous. You know, where the Ku Klux Klan is tweeting out, hey, you terrorists, we're not going to stand by and take it. And, you know, be prepared to be confronted by, you know, patriots who don't believe in your stuff. I'm paraphrasing.
And
let me do a sidebar here just for a moment. Because we did not anticipate this show today, normally on the Lynch O'Fallon Facebook page, I would have posted like a dozen articles relevant to this, hopefully reflecting as many perspectives on this story as I could. Because we've gone live with no real preparation and we've usurped the planned show, all of these articles, things that Bobby's talking about now, things that I'm alluding to, I will be posting all that information on the Lynch O'Fallon Facebook page as soon as the show goes down today. And I apologize that I'm not multitasking, but I usually have a co-pilot who can put those things up as we speak. And I'd really rather sort of be clear and present for what we're talking about. So end of sidebar with my apologies. Anyone who listens to this streaming later, go to Lynch O'Fallon Facebook page, and you'll be able to see all the articles that we're referring to today. So anyway, the KKK formation of resistance to terrorism. Okay, this is what they're saying. Got it. But Anonymous thought they crossed a line somewhere and sort of responded to them. So then the KKK responds to Anonymous and go, oh, you're a bunch of posers. You know, who are you anyway? You don't matter. You're nobody. And so Anonymous responded by hacking and stealing the KKK tweet, the Twitter account, and then sort of stopped all this pro-violence rhetoric, because the number of people who were responding kind of hoorah about, let's get our guns, was actually upsetting and startling. And definitely, you know, in that gray zone, if you want to call it, where freedom of speech, there are times when freedom of speech is supported by the Constitution. You pointed to yelling fire in a theater. Another one is that anything that is inciting violence, you know, with the intent to harm. And so that was an interesting boxing match that we had. Another, of course, is the whole, I'm trying to find a great way to say this. The grand jury process itself, I mean, we talked about that, but the grand jury process itself has been being vilified. You know, why is it a secret? Right. Why is it a secret? Well, the answer is because it's always a secret. You know, I'm one of those people that have been, I've never been on a grand jury, but I've been on jury duty. I can't tell you how many times. And just, you know, I'm one of those lucky ones. You know, I win contests when I enter, and that included being on jury. And I think that the naivete that is being played to when people sort of rant on about the grand jury is sort of evidence of how we're not teaching civics. We're not vetting information that we share. We're not, you know. And so that part concerns me just as much as all the rest. That we're
There's no doubt that that's going on. Yeah.
Right.
So you know,
well,
Dan Johnson is in queue for you as well.
Oh, I don't see him. Oh my gosh! Can you tell me his phone number?
Is it?
Well, I'll tell you what. There's one number here that has come up that I cannot identify. I'm going to open the mic for
code.
567. There you go, Dan Johnson. Welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
Thanks for having me on again. Sorry I didn't respond quick enough.
Oh, listen, no, it's all good. This is how things go for citizen journalists, I think. And so I'm just thrilled that I got this last-minute call and that we can actually go live with this. So for our listeners, Lunch with Loudon spoke with Dan Johnson some time ago about his actions as the founder of People Against the NDAA, PANDA. And then most recently, we spoke again about what was happening in Ferguson. I think I've alluded to this already, that Dan was a citizen journalist, live streaming, and really being the coffee party eyes and ears on the ground. Yeah, seemed like he was eyes and ears on the ground for a lot of people, but I like to claim him because I so appreciate your perspective, Dan. And I love that you can actually look with unbiased eyes and tell us what you see, because that's the only way folks like me are going to feel confident that we have an understanding about what's going on. So, and I also apologize, I didn't know your number. I didn't know that one. So, you've been listening to Bobby and me rant on for a couple of minutes. Is there someplace you would just like to start in terms of sharing? Are you in Ferguson now? Are you on your way there? How closely are you following this?
Yeah, thanks for having me on again. And I'm following it very closely, but to be honest, with my skill set, I can't do anything by going there again, at least not when this is happening. There's nothing I could do that could possibly add value to the cost that it would take to get back down there and find a place to stay and all that stuff. There are a couple other live streamers on the ground, so when things start happening in Ferguson, Revolutionary Z for the Free Thought Project, a friend of mine, right, or acquaintance of mine at least, he'll be on the ground,
right,
as well as InfoWars has done great coverage, they'll be on the ground. There'll be a couple other people who will be there to help, and I'm sure they'll teach some other live streamers when they're out there to help cover it video-wise. But I think there's some important points that are not brought up in discussions about Ferguson, about what's about to happen. And one of them is why violence? Why is violence coming? When I left Ferguson, there were two groups of protesters telling me two different things. The first group told me that I don't want it to, but if Darren Wilson isn't indicted, the city will burn. And they're talking about St. Louis. And the second is, if Darren Wilson is not indicted, I'll burn the city. There was very little, maybe a minority, one or two, maybe three people, who I talked to who did not say either the city will burn or I'll burn it myself. And I think this really speaks to where violence, and it requires an examination of why are they looking at violence. And the fact is, throughout history, including our very own American quote-unquote revolution, when people have found political system to fail them entirely, they resort to violence. When people in mass, I mean, there are some criminals, there's people who the system doesn't have to fail, but when people in mass resort to violence, it is when they believe, whether it has or whether it hasn't, the perception is there that they believe the system has failed them completely. And that perception is definitely there among most of the protesters in Ferguson, St. Louis, in that area. And this is something that those currently hold elected office, those who are in the police, those who are in the National Guard units there, should have recognized. They should have recognized that regardless of what we believe the system is like, it is right now perceived as broken. And if we don't take steps to make it at least destroy that perception that it's not transparent and destroy that perception that it's not broken and show that it actually does work, an inevitable outcome of that will be violence. Now, the only people who can stop this violence are the protesters themselves, because it appears, to me at least, with the governor's demanding of a state of emergency, with the actions being taken thus far by leadership, political leadership in the area, it appears to me that the state government and local government did not get the memo. And so the only people who can prevent a widespread violence in St. Louis, not necessarily in Ferguson, because I think those people have learned a lot from the violence that they faced last time and how that hurts local business, but in St. Louis, if they're to avoid that type of violence in St. Louis, then the protesters have to self-police. And I don't know if they can. I don't know if they can combat that mentality. You know, Radley Balco wrote an article for the Washington Post. It was Washington Post. I remember right. I think that's who he works for.
Yeah,
he was the author of Rise of the Warrior Cop, so he was covering Ferguson very closely. He wrote an article in the Washington Post where he called the lower court system in St. Louis a series of fiefdoms. And he called them that because of the way they prosecute traffic tickets and the way they go after traffic tickets. There are a lot of outstanding warrants in Ferguson. Most of them are for failure to appear in court on a traffic ticket. So you have, in many ways, the people there believe the system is broken. And now I may show my ignorance here, and you can slap me down if you need to. But if I know grand jury systems correctly, he, after being indicted, will go to another trial to be determined whether or not he will be convicted. Correct?
That is correct.
If they indict him, if I were in their shoes right now, I would, to destroy the perception the political system is broken, I would indict him and send him to trial. Thomas Jefferson talks about on matters of principle, stand like a rock. On matters of art or matters of I forget what the other one is. I don't even remember my own quote now. on matters of principle, stand like a rock. On matters of something swim with the current. It's kind of the style. Matters of style swim with the current. And if Darren Wilson is indicted, that does not violate his rights. He will still get an open trial in front of a jury.
That's correct.
And right now they have the chance to at least show, hey, you talked about the perception about the secrecy of the grand jury system. I tell you that's there. I guarantee you that's there with the protesters. They view it as secret. They view it as being held from their sight. They view the system as completely broken. The one step, if I were in command of the situation or I had a say in the situation at all, the one step I would make is to indict the officer. Treat him as if you were treating someone who is not a government agent. Someone, if I was accused of murder, I'd go straight to court, or I'd go straight to jail first and then court. Treat him no different than you treat a normal person. Indict him, send him to trial. Show these people there is transparency. If they don't do that, I have to say it's very likely we're going to see this, we're going to see a lot of violence in St. Louis, and there's really nothing else I could say about it.
Well, I have to say, Dan, that I totally agree with you that to be an indictment is not an admission of guilt, but it does move this process from behind closed doors, whether it's an internal investigation, whatever grand jury, into the public arena. And I'm with you. I think that if this man is innocent, it will be provable. And it's another thing, perhaps, not to like the outcome, but at least it won't be happening behind closed doors. You know, this would be something that we can all see. And I'm with you that I like the quote about stand like a rock or swim with the current and being able to know the difference. There's probably some political serenity prayer there. And I so appreciate the notion that sometimes we just have to prove, you know, to ourselves and each other that this system is salvageable, whether it's broken or not, is it salvageable? You know, I think we can all admit that there are things about which we have concern, things that we think, you know, somebody took a wrong turn somewhere and we sort of need to, you know, it's like the GPS going redirecting or recalculating your route. And we need to recalculate our route back to a clear understanding of the rights and responsibilities of citizenship and the rights and responsibilities of governance, and not have it be so, you know, so what the guy's an oath keeper, so what the guy's a member of the Ku Klux Klan, or so what's the guy's from the Black Congressional Caucus. That's less important than the process of law. And I think when we disregard the significance of due process to this republic's democracy, then we're really in a world of hurt.
But you know, one of the things, too, that is interesting about what Dan and you had just said is that from the standpoint of civil rights and from the standpoint of the Black community's legitimate, mind you, legitimate complaint about how they've been treated by the police, without question.
Yes.
One of the things that they have consistently said, the responsible leaderships and the responsible response of the community has been, all we want is the process. We want them to be held accountable, and if in fact they are found not guilty, they are found not guilty. You know, it reminds me, so much of this reminds me of the O.J. situation. I always thought throughout that entire process that he was never going to be found guilty by that jury because of the history of L.A. and the fact that it was right inside of L.A. County and the makeup of the jury. I basically thought it was going to be a protest decision, and considering how fast it came back, I thought it kind of validated my thoughts on that way back then. And I think that what you guys are describing is exactly that. They want to have the access to the process. So, yes, it would definitely put the officer, you know, he'd have to spend some money. He'd have to have the stigma of being charged. But, yes, put him in front of a jury of his peers and make the government prove that there was a crime or their failure to do so. Absolutely. I think that is the great way to go, and that's an excellent reference to the Jefferson quote, Dan, without a doubt.
And
well, Dan,
on that,
go ahead.
On that note, I want to mention something about the National Guard in particular. I think, based on my experience down there and based on human psychology in general, that activating the National Guard is an absolutely awful decision. It was an awful decision the first time. It's an awful decision this time.
Absolutely.
And the reason being isn't so much that the National Guard would be better prepared or less prepared, or a matter of the preparation of the National Guard to deal with the upcoming protests. It's a matter of a couple things. It doesn't really matter how well, and yes, I would agree, the National Guard probably treated me better than the police did down there. I would say that on a practical level, they may be better equipped to handle the situation. But two things are very important to know here. Number one is a statistic not often brought up, is that there were no black-on-black gang violence murders in the 7 days after Mike Brown was shot. None in those 7 days afterward. And as a gang member I was speaking with and actually hung out with for a little bit, was telling me, he says, that's never happened, ever. The protesters aren't necessarily gearing up for war, but the gangs are. And if you present them with a war, aka the army, when's the last time the army was used? Oh, race riots. And now we're bringing us back to the civil rights days. Do you really want to put that, number one, do you really want to put that image in their head? And number two, when Ferguson went down, the Ferguson police did not participate. When the protests started going down, Chief Jackson, reached out to Chief Belmar of the St. Louis County Police and said, you guys take care of it. So they brought out their tactical teams. As a St. Louis County police officer, you don't care as much what you do to protesters in Ferguson because you don't live there, because you won't have to deal with it, and you won't have to think about moving if you don't want to deal with it. As National Guard, you don't even live in the city or in the surrounding area or in the county. You will very likely face zero repercussions from your actions toward protesters in Ferguson. The Ferguson police are the ones who should be handling and should have handled the situation from the start, because when they go out there and act on a human level, on a thinking about themselves, what are they going to do after they get home level, they know they live in that city. And therefore, they have to be accountable to the people in that city. And so whether or not the National Guard is prepared or better prepared to take on mass protests is irrelevant. What matters is when I was down there in Ferguson, the police instigated the violence. It's not going to take much. It is not going to take much to instigate violence out of an otherwise peaceful situation in mass. And you are less likely to do it if you bring their hometown police department there, because those police officers know that when they go home, they have to live with the consequences of their actions.
Well, Dan, isn't that consistent with the whole notion that there's something become painfully obvious lately, which is the difference between community policing, the philosophy and strategy of community policing, versus the militarization of the police? I know this is a big topic soon after the incident there, but it spawned many, many great pieces of work about how valuable community policing has proven itself to be, and how over time, as they get better and better at it and as it spreads from community to community, I mean, it's just proven to reduce the need for police intervention, let alone manage differently what happens when there is police intervention. And so what you're speaking to is that if we could stay with the community policing model, where people have a vested interest in how their community is operated, but also a knowledge, an intimate knowledge of that community, it's going to be a totally different result from when you march in riot gear with vehicles of aggression and basically take a stand by your dress and your demeanor, you know, that says bring it on. You know, I think there's a lot of literature out there, there's a lot of evidence, but that's just asking, or it's almost a request for violence to present yourself that way. And so what you're saying is that was your experience as well.
You can't say, especially to a young man, bring it. I mean, that's the start of a bar fight. I mean, and that's just on that level. But when you step up, and when Missouri Governor Jay Nixon, who is white, sends out the National Guard in Missouri, the last state to stop using slaves, and the last state to get rid of a lot of oppressive, racially motivated laws. In fact, what most people don't want to focus on is the inherent institutional racism throughout Missouri, such as you will notice that Missouri's concealed carry permit laws have changed. They are now shall issue. They used to be may issue until the Missouri government did a study and found that out of 1,000 people who were arrested and their only felony was carrying a concealed weapon without a permit, one of them was white. They changed that law to shall issue. There is a lot of institutional racism in Missouri, and the people know this. So you have a white governor who activates the National Guard. The Homeland Security is there. The police department has ordered riot gear. They're ready for war. You send a message to all the young men in the community, especially if you don't indict him. If you do not indict the officer, the message you send is, we didn't care about you. Those who told you that the system might work are wrong. It won't work. And try and stop us. And that's not a message you want to send to young men, being one, I know.
Well, it's not what they would, their grandmothers want to hear either, and being one, I know.
One grandfather in the house as well.
But truly, I it is such a bring-it-on statement. There have been studies that have proven it's a bring-it-on statement. There are studies that prove that community policing is effective and preventive. You know, isn't that what you seek? I don't know if you were on the line already when I said, you know, I'm old enough to remember Kent State very vividly, to have marched in the candlelight marches after that terrible day. And the idea that the National Guard is being called out just, you know, made me shiver in my socks. You know, it's like when you hear a helicopter. I don't like the sound of a helicopter either. It's just like it's not in me to not defend myself or hide from helicopters.
By another Nixon, I might add.
Indeed. Oh, man, don't even take me there. But, and so, you know, the one jumping around I'm doing on the internet right now is that I've got this one link to basically Ferguson grand jury results. I keep jumping there. I refresh the page. I still don't see results, and certainly we will. You know, that may or may not happen before we're off the air today. But what, Janine, what can you do about situations like this? Obviously, one of them is to have a radio show, talk to Dan Johnson, talk to Bobby Rodrigo, and try to demystify the process and encourage resistance to violence, you know, nonviolent resistance to violence. And when you speak to Ferguson knows better, they know the cost of this kind of violence, and they're not going to let it happen in their town. I find it interesting then that there's a secondary destination, which is St. Louis. And how on purpose is that? How strategic is all of this? I mean, from what I read, it sounds strategic, but I can't really say I know that with authority. I just sort of feel it in my bones.
Well,
you know, one thing I will say, and I will offer to that as well, is where are the elected officials on the ground? Now, you know, a lot of people, including us, will, in my view, misinterpret what they are and call them leaders. But this is something that is so important that they should be there on the ground talking to their communities that put them in office to do this very thing, to be their liaison from themselves to the government, and they need to have their boots on the ground as well. So I throw that in there as well.
I think it's important. One thing that is not profitable for news organizations to do, but is a necessary factor, no one speaks for the protesters as a whole. It's a spontaneous protest. I do my best to refer to, when I see a trend, I say most of the protesters, or many of them, or much of them, or a lot of them. I will not say they all are represented. And I think that's a key mistake and a monetized editorial purposeful mistake made by a lot of news organizations, because if you can characterize all of them as rioters or all of them as peaceful, then you'll get people who believe in that to click on your article. But it's not the case. There are many different groups vying for many different types of control. That being said, I think there's going to be, at the very least, less violence in Ferguson because of the people who were on the ground and learned what violence can do to you, what it can do to your stores, what it can do to your businesses and your economy. They don't want to burn down their own economy. And the target, however, is St. Louis because, A, it's the biggest city. It's the symbol of power. It's the symbol, you know, it's not Jeff City because they're not going to go all the way over to the governor's mansion. But St. Louis isn't that far. And it's a symbol of white power and authority and tyranny and oppression to the people down there. And so, and on another factor is those who are in St. Louis feel Ferguson. It hits them close to home, but they didn't see what it was like at the protests themselves. So they didn't know the cost of, and they don't understand as much the cost of violence. It is St. Louis that will bear the brunt. It will not be Ferguson.
That makes
Janine
sense.
And Dan, I have to say goodbye. I got to get off the phone. And I wanted to say thanks, Janine, for being on the show. And thanks always, Dan. Always great to work with you. And coffee party on. And I'll talk to you guys later.
Bobby Rodrigo, thank you so much for joining Lunch with Loudon. So we are, Dan, approaching the end of our hour, and I am curious if there's any go forth and ... or any last insights that you'd like to share that you may have not, I may not have given you the opportunity to share today.
And once again, I appreciate coming on the program, and it's always good to have a kind of a laid-back, rational discussion that you don't get in a lot of other shows. But I think I was at the Million Mask March on November 5th as a commemoration of Guy Fawkes Day, remember the 5th of November, doing some live streaming down there. And when I was there, I gave a bit of a speech in front of the White House, and that was, we see a lot in movies about revolutions, such as V for Vendetta, or such as, just think of a revolutionary movie. Think of a movie that contains a revolution in it. And a lot of them, or most of them, contain images and video of people rallying in the streets and taking back their streets. And I don't, after studying world revolutions and looking into not just the flash and pomp and circumstance of the revolution itself, but what happened afterward, what substantial change did they make, I find that it's not a we revolution. It's a you, it's an I, it's a me revolution. You are the only one who will decide how free you live. No one else can decide that for you. You are the only one who will decide how free you live. And you are the only one who will decide whether or not your city becomes Ferguson. You are the only one who will decide whether or not you support a tyrannical oppressor. You are the only one in that decision. No one else can make it for you. So stop waiting on other people to tell you what to do or to do it with you. Stop waiting on a bunch of people to gather together and jump in. You yourself can do little things like ask your police department how they refer to themselves as community policing. Get in a conversation with your chief. How do you consider yourselves community police officers? Get them thinking. Talk to them. You know, contact your local government and find out, can we get body cams on our police officers? Can we get this kind of transparency, this update of the police report for the 21st century on our police officers? You yourself are the only one who can change things in your world. And the only difference between me and someone else is I stepped up. I'm a regular person. I was 18. I didn't know anything about politics. I stumbled along, hit every pothole that came across my path. But the only difference between me and some of the people listening to this radio broadcast is I stepped up. And that can be you. The difference between you and your neighbor is you stepped up. All it will take is one, and all it will take is you. You are the revolution. Stop waiting for somebody else.
Magnificent. Thank you so much. This is why I enjoy talking to you so much, is because I really believe the whole thing is you can fall for anything if you stand for nothing. And so when I hear someone say, this is what I stand for, I'm so assured that all of this is worth it and that this will go well. If we all become the active citizen that we are inside, you know, we all have opinions. There, it's in there. And we just have to believe that bringing it out is worth the risk. And you just affirm for me that it is. Ben Johnson, thank you so much for joining me on Lunch with Dalton today. A pleasure, as always.
And thank you very much for having me. If people want to check out or support my work, they can go to solutions-institute.org. That's solutions-institute.org. If they've got a quick question, they can always tweet us at ActivistHelp. That institute launches on January 1st as the first ever activism consulting firm. So I'm very excited.
Hey, I'll post your link in Lunch with Loudon on Facebook. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye.
I'm so taken by the relevance of this conversation. I just clicked on the grand jury decision in Ferguson again, and there's been no decision made as of closing the show today. I want to thank you all for taking the time to be with us on Lunch with Loudon. Come to our Facebook page in a few minutes, or if you're streaming now, and we'll have background articles that support the conversations we had today. I want to remind you that Coffee Party USA is totally a crowdsourced organization. Citizens United has not benefited us. To become a voting member or to donate to this total volunteer organization, go to www.coffeepartyusa.com and find the big red donate join button. Thanks so much, and Coffee Party on.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling good.